From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Red Fingers. Many of my ghost hunts, from what promised in the beginning to be a routine investigation of a simple enough haunting, held a twist in the tale. A prime example is the case of the Rowlandsons. I met Mr. and Mrs. Robert Rowlandson many years ago in Perth. They told me they were just quitting a badly haunted house on the outskirts of the city. The name of the house was Bocarth. It was their own, and had only been built a year, but they could not possibly remain in it. They said because of the ghostly disturbances to which they were subjected. "What strikes us as so extraordinary about the whole thing," Mrs. Rowlandson said, "is that a new house with absolutely no history attached to it, and we can assure you," she added laughingly, "there were no murders or suicides there during our occupancy. Should be haunted. Our neighbors say we must have brought the ghost with us." The couple were just beginning a detailed description of the manifestations when I asked them to stop. I explained that I would like to investigate the case, and that if they agreed, it would be better for me to do so without having any prior knowledge of the nature of the hauntings. They were quite willing, provided I promised not to discuss the matter too openly, as they wanted to let the house, that I should spend a few nights at Bocarth. They were rather anxious to know if anything unusual still took place there. Thinking perhaps that I might not like to go alone, they gave me an introduction to a young friend of theirs, Dr. Swinton, who they thought might be interested to accompany me. That same day the Rowlandsons went off to Edinburgh, where they told me they now intended living, and the following day at noon I made my way to the house they had vacated. As there was no story connected with Bocarth itself, I made inquiries about the ground on which it stood, and it may interest the reader to know my findings, as an example of the exasperatingly negative direction in which these inquiries, though very necessary, often lead. Instead of learning too little, I learned too much. An old minister of about 80 was sure that the ground in question, until built upon recently, had been grazing land since he was a boy, and that it had never witnessed anything more extraordinary than the occasional death of a sheep or a cow that had been struck by lightning. An equally aged and positive postmistress declared that the ground had never been anything better than wasteland, where, amid rubbish heaps galore, all the dogs in the parish might have been scratching and fighting over bones. Another person remembered a pond being there, and another a nursery garden, but from no one could I extract the slightest hint of anything that might account for the haunting. Then, when I entered the house, I thought I had seldom seen such a cheerful residence. The rooms were light and lofty, and about them all there was an air of friendliness and warmth. There could scarcely have been a more unghostly atmosphere. Dr. Swinton joined me in the evening, but although we sat up till long after dawn, we neither saw nor heard anything we could not account for by natural causes. We repeated the vigil for two more nights, after which we concluded that the house was either no longer haunted, or that the hauntings were periodical and might not occur again for years. I wrote as much to Mr. Rowlandson, returning the keys of the house, and in reply received the following letter from him in Edinburgh. "Dear Mr. O'Donnell, many thanks for the keys. No wonder you did not see our ghost. It is here, and we are having just the same experiences in this house as we had in Bocarth. If you would care to stay a few nights with us on the chance of seeing the ghost, we shall be delighted to put you up. Yours, etc., Robert Rowlandson." I could not resist the Rowlandson's kind invitation, and just as soon as I could, caught the train for Edinburgh. When I arrived at their house, situated in a pleasant crescent, it was to find the entire household in a panic, the ghost having appeared to one and all during the previous night. It was so terrible, Mrs. Rowlandson told me, that I cannot bear even to think of it, and shall certainly never forget it. One of the maids fainted and was so ill afterwards we were obliged to have the doctor. Now all the servants have given notice to leave.
Did nothing of the sort happen before you went to Bocarth? I asked.
No, said Mr. Rowlandson, not a thing. We were then skeptics where ghosts were concerned, but we are certainly not skeptical now.
Do you think it is possible, I said, that the ghost is attached to some piece of old furniture? There have been such cases.
No, he replied, we have no old furniture. All our furniture is modern and new. At least it was new when we went to Bocarth.
Then, if the ghost is neither attached to the house, nor to the ground, nor to the furniture, it must surely be attached to some person, I said.
I suppose no one in the house has gone in for spiritualism?
I can tell you I haven't, Mr. Rowlandson said. And you haven't either, Maud, have you?
Mrs. Rowlandson flushed.
The only spiritualist I ever knew, she said, was, you know, dear, who I mean.
Her husband stared at her.
I don't, he said. Who?
Ernest Deacon.
Deacon, he exclaimed.
Of course. Some years ago, Mr. O'Donnell, he explained to me, my wife met this Mr. Deacon at a ball given by a mutual friend, and from that time up to shortly before his death abroad, he persecuted her with his undesirable attentions. I never knew anyone so persistent.
He resented your marriage?
I should think he did, said Mr. Rowlandson, though to everyone's surprise, he came to the wedding. I shall never forget the expression on his face.
Mr. Deacon was a spiritualist, I asked.
He was very keen on seances, Mrs. Rowlandson broke in to say.
Most keen, and was at one time always trying to persuade me to go to one with him.
You never told me that, said her husband.
No, said his wife, but I never went.
How did Mr. Deacon die, I asked.
Suicide, said Mr. Rowlandson.
He shot himself, and left a note stating that his death was entirely due to the heartless conduct of my wife.
When was that?
Mr. Rowlandson thought for a moment.
We have been married not quite 18 months, about 15 months ago, shortly before we went to Bocarth.
I know what's in your mind, Mrs. Rowlandson said to me. Do you really think that it could be the spirit of Ernest Deacon that is troubling us?
I told her it seemed more than likely, and asked when the phenomenon usually appeared.
At all times, and when we least expect it, she replied. For example, if I am going upstairs alone, it either springs out at me or peers down at me from over the banisters, or again, it rouses us in the middle of the night by rocking our bed. Always some alarming trick of that kind.
Then you would hardly expect it to manifest itself if we all sat here in the dark.
Hardly. I asked if there was a photograph of Mr. Deacon.
There was not, but Mrs. Rowlandson described him. She remembered particularly the look of his hands. The fingers were long and red, and the tips were club-shaped. I am sure I would recognize them anywhere. This conversation took place in the evening before dinner. After dinner, we sat in the drawing room discussing plans for the night. We decided that when bedtime came, we should retire to our respective rooms and sit there in the dark, waiting and watching. Directly anyone heard or saw anything, he would summon the others. We sat up late, and it was close on midnight, before Mrs. Rowlandson rose, and we all, there were two guests besides myself, a colonel and Mrs. Rushworth, took our candlesticks and followed her upstairs. We had mounted the first flight, and had turned a bend leading to the second. The house seemed all stairs, when Mrs. Rowlandson stopped and, looking back at us, said,
"Shh! Do you hear something?"
We stood and listened. There was a thump, which apparently came from a room just at the top of the stairs, then another, and then a very curious sound, as if something was bounding backwards and forwards over bare boards with its feet tied together. At a signal from Mr. Rowlandson, he immediately blew out our lights. A church clock struck 12. We heard it distinctly, as the Rowlandsons, being enthusiasts for fresh air, kept practically every window in the house open. The reverberation of the final stroke had scarcely ceased when a loud gasp from someone in front of me sent me a chilly feeling down my spine. At the same moment, the darkness ahead of us was lighted by a faint luminous glow. The glow speedily intensified and suddenly took the shape of a cylindrical column of 6 or 7 feet in height, and this in turn developed a startling abruptness into the form of something so shockingly grotesque that I was appalled. It is extremely difficult to give a very accurate description of it, because, like much of the occult phenomena I have experienced in haunted houses, it was a baffling mixture of the distinct and yet vague, entirely without substance, and apparently wholly constituted of vibrating light which varied each time in tone and intensity. I can only say that the impression I derived was that of a very gross or monstrous man. The head, ill-defined on the crown and sides, appeared to be abnormally high and long, and to be covered with a tangled mass of coarse, tow-colored hair. The nose seemed hooked, the mouth cruel, the eyes leering. The body of the thing was gray and nude, very like the trunk of a silver birch, the arms long and knotted, the hands huge, the fingers red and club-shaped, corresponding exactly with Mrs. Rowlandson's description. The baleful apparition seemed without doubt to be the spirit of Ernest Deacon. This was the ghost which could shut and open doors, move furniture, rap, and make other noises. It could also convey the sensation of intense cold and the feeling of the most dreadful fear. I find myself wondering if it possessed other properties. Was it sensible? Could it communicate in any way? While I was deliberating, the figure seemed to move forward. Then someone shrieked. Mr. Rowlandson struck a light and simultaneously the apparition vanished. The effect it had on us all was striking. We were all more or less demoralized. Yet no two of us had seen the ghost the same, while Mr. Rowlandson and Mrs. Rushworth had not seen it at all. We went back to the drawing room and discussed it. Mrs. Rowlandson was the first to speak. She, too, had been particularly impressed by the hands, and was sure they were the hands of Ernest Deacon. "I can say nothing about the face," she said, "as it did not appear to me. But having seen the hands, I am firmly convinced that the ghost is Ernest Deacon, and that it is he who is tormenting us. Cannot any of you think of a plan to get rid of him?" "Cremation is the only thing I can think of," said Colonel Rushworth, who up to now had been silent. "That is the means employed by the hill tribes in northern India. When a spirit they can identify, begins to haunt a place, they dig up the body and burn it. And they say as soon as the last bone is consumed, the haunting stops. They have a theory that phantoms of dead people and animals can materialize as long as someone or some remnant of their physical body remains. Where did this Mr. Deacon die?" "In Africa," said Mr. Rowlandson. "Well," said the colonel, "in that case, if we can check the cemetery, there ought to be no difficulty in arranging for the body to be exhumed. The officials are, as a rule, open to bribery. Anyhow, you might try it as an experiment." I left Edinburgh next day, but I heard some months later from Mr. Rowlandson. His letter was short and cheery, and in it he wrote, "You may recollect Colonel Rushworth's suggestion. Well, the hauntings have ceased, and I am glad to tell you we are shortly returning to Bocarth, from which I gathered that an attempt to exhume and cremate Ernest Deacon's body had been made, and had proved successful." The listener. People who attempt to exchange words with an apparition very seldom succeed in drawing a response, or indeed any recognition at all, of their own presence. This is true of most of my own efforts to communicate with ghostly figures. Excluding those of the deliberately harmful and belligerent kind, the majority of ghosts, when addressed, pay no heed, but simply continue about their purpose. In a little case I am reminded of, however, even if the witness drew no response from the figure she saw, her words to it did seem to have an ultimate effect. I met Mrs. Nora Barrington at a social evening in London, and in the course of our conversation together, we touched on ghosts. I happened to ask, just by the way, if she knew anyone who had actually spoken with an apparition, and she replied it at once. "Oh, yes, I have spoken to one myself." On my pressing her to describe her experience, this is what she told me. "Some years ago, I rented the top flat of a terrace house in a Kensington Square. The rooms below me were occupied by a solicitor's clerk and his wife, while the landlady, Mrs. Bowen, lived on the ground floor. My two sisters, Gertrude and Pamela, lived with me, sharing the extra bedroom, and it was not very long before they began to complain that someone came up our stairs at night with very heavy footsteps. Gertrude said she was sure it was a man, as no woman could tread so heavily. He always came to our door, and after remaining outside it for some minutes, walked away again. Thinking this very strange, I mentioned the matter to Mrs. Bowen, who sympathetically dismissed the idea of there being an intruder. She explained that the acoustic properties of the houses in our terrace were such as often made it extremely difficult to locate sounds accurately. She herself frequently fancied she heard someone about the passages, she told me, when in reality it was merely the people next door. Half persuaded that what she suggested was correct, and being anxious to allay the suspicions of my sisters, who are naturally timid, I pretended I was satisfied. A few days later, our dressmaker, who was at work in the dining room doing some alterations for Pamela, told me she would like to see Pamela for a minute or so, if it would not be disturbing her. "I know she has someone with her," the dressmaker explained, "as I heard a gentleman come up and go into the drawing room, but I really won't keep her more than a minute." "Are you sure my sister has company?" I asked. "Oh, yes," she replied. "I couldn't help thinking what a very heavy tread he had. It quite shook the table here." Just then, Pamela came in, and noticing the intent expression on my face, inquired what was the matter. "I was just asking if I might see you, miss, about the skirt," the dressmaker said, "and was apologizing to Miss Nora for disturbing you, as I knew you had company." "Company?" exclaimed Pamela. "Why, whatever do you mean? We don't have visitors at this hour in the morning." The dressmaker was disconcerted, but still quite adamant. "Begging your pardon, miss," she said, "didn't a gentleman enter the parlor just now? I am sure I heard someone, a gentleman with a very heavy tread." Pamela turned very white. "You must have heard someone next door," she faltered. "At least, that is how Mrs. Bowen explains it." "If you ask me," the dressmaker said, shaking her head solemnly, "I'd say this house is haunted." She finished Pamela's dress, but nothing could induce her to come to the house again. A day or two after this incident, a solicitor's clerk and his wife in the flat below us went away for their holiday. On the night of their departure, at about 12 o'clock, my sisters were awakened by the sounds from the vacated rooms, tramping on the stairs and in the passages, the opening and slamming to of doors, and the hustling about of furniture. And much annoyed that the couple should disturb the house by their arriving at such a late hour, my sisters complained to Mrs. Bowen. She was greatly embarrassed, admitted that her tenants had not returned, and that the noises could not be accounted for. Seeing the look in all our eyes, she then added, "I suppose I ought to have explained to you that the house is said to be haunted, but I delayed doing so, hoping you would get used to the noises. You understand, Miss Nora, that this house is my bread and butter, and if it once got the reputation of harboring ghosts, I should be ruined. The ghosts won't hurt any of you, and, oh, I do beg of you not to mention it to any of your friends." Feeling really sorry for her, though she had tried to deceive us, we promised, and as I was the least nervous of the trio, we changed bedrooms, Gertrude and Pamela going into mine, and I moving to the haunted one. At first, I did not dare to sleep in the dark, but left the gas burning, taking the additional precaution of locking the door. I awoke at midnight to hear the sounds, the heavy tread, 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 of a man's step on the staircase and along the passage. All my senses at once became painfully acute, and sitting up in bed, I listened with strained ears. Nearer and nearer they came. The heavy lumbering tread of a big, unwieldy man. I was now so terrified that I felt I must die should the ghost succeed in entering the room. Arriving outside the door, it halted, and then the door handle was gently turned. I was horrified, expecting that the locked door would fly open and that I should see some awful face. Fortunately for me, however, this did not happen. The handle ceased turning, and for some seconds there was a sound of heavy breathing. Then the same labored step slowly strode away. I was much ashamed of myself, Mr. O'Donnell, for being such a coward. I ought to have unlocked and opened the door, and at least made an attempt to converse with the ghost, for it seemed quite apparent that it wanted to communicate something, or it would not have walked away like that. I worried over this day after day until at last I determined I should see the apparition, no matter what risk this incurred. Night came, and I retired to bed as usual, putting out the gas, however, and leaving the door unlocked. I soon fell into a deep sleep from which I was abruptly awakened by the most appalling crash, and on starting up, I saw, leaning over the foot of my bedstead and glaring at me, the figure of a man, a tall man with black hair, the upper part of his face agreeably handsome, but the lower part disconcertingly brutal. His eyes, large and dark, were fixed on mine, with a most agonized expression, as of one irredeemably damned. He was immaculately dressed in evening clothes, every detail being startlingly visible from the luminous glow that seemed to emanate from his entire person, in contrast to the darkness of the room. For some moments, to me an eternity, I gazed at him, far too frightened to speak, and then my courage gradually returning, I moistened my parched lips, and with an effort mumbled out a few words. I cannot recollect what I said, but as my one and only thought in those first few seconds of fear was to get rid of the apparition as quickly as possible, I believe I resorted to a wild prayer of exorcism. But it had no effect, the ghost remaining silent and motionless, the sound of my own voice reassuring me, and the preliminary shock of the encounter being over, I grew rapidly calmer and asked the figure a variety of questions, hoping I might be able to obtain valuable information about the future world. But in this, I was doomed to disappointment, for he either could not or would not reply. Seeing the futility of further questioning, I decided on a gentler form of address. I tried to explain to him how absolutely necessary it was for him to overcome his evil ways if he would ever tear himself away from this earth. I begged him to continually pray to Christ to help him, assuring him that there was hope of redemption even for the most debased of mankind, for anyone, in fact, who could once be brought to full recognition of the enormity of their sins. When once you begin to repent in grim earnest, I said, the fetters that bind you here will be loosened, and you will speedily rise to the highest spiritual sphere, to paradise. I continued to talk to him in this manner for a long time, until, in fact, the clock struck two, when, to my great relief, he suddenly vanished. Well, Mr. O'Donnell, that was not the end. Far from it. He kept on visiting me almost nightly for nearly 3 months, and on each occasion I spoke to him in the same strain. Although he always listened attentively, he never replied. Perhaps he could not speak, but his eyes gradually lost their expression of despair, and the last time he appeared to me, I was elated beyond measure to see in his face a look of gratitude and joy. He then vanished, and the heavy footsteps were heard no more.